This is Mark Sobel, U.S. Chairman of OMFIF. The G20 Leader Summit will take place in Buenos Aires, Argentina, on November 31st and December 1st. To help preview the summit, I'm delighted to be joined today by Caroline Atkinson. Caroline was a senior member of President Obama's National Security Council, including several years as the U.S. Sherpa in charge of leading U.S. preparations for G20 Leader Summits. Who better to provide us context on the upcoming meetings in Buenos Aires? She has a long and distinguished career in international finance and public policy, including stints as an FT journalist, an IMF staffer, and head of the International Monetary Fund's Communications Department, and most checkered of all, she was my predecessor at U.S. Treasury as Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Monetary and Financial Policy. Welcome, Caroline.
Hi, Mark. Very nice to be chatting with you again.
A pleasure. The summit president rotates annually. Argentine President Macri wanted the chair to show that Argentina was reintegrating with the world after a decade of tension between his predecessors and the international community. But along came a nasty crisis in Argentina. It was certainly not the year he expected.
That's exactly right, Mark. It has indeed been a very difficult year for Argentina. Markets turned sour on the country and it ran into a bad balance of payments crisis that was quite reminiscent of the old ones and of his predecessors. So instead of welcoming global leaders to his capital from a position of strength, with a well-planned and interesting agenda for the summit, President Macri and his staff have had to scramble. And that's embarrassing for the host of a meeting like this. In fact, his creditors, the major shareholders of the IMF, are all the leaders of the G20, and they will be his guests around the summit table. And of course, at the same time, the firefighting to calm foreign exchange markets has left Argentina's government with somewhat limited bandwidth to manage the preparation for the G20. But I will say one thing that Macri has had going for him is that the US in particular has been tremendously supportive. And that comes from the top. President Trump organized for his staff to push the IMF to move quickly to put a program and loans in place to help Argentina. So in normal times, one might expect that Trump and other leaders would work together, maybe feeling a bit sorry for their host, to have a smooth and perhaps less inspiring, but smooth summit and communique. Of course, we don't live in normal times.
Absolutely. And after the contentiousness at the G7 leaders meeting earlier this year and recently the flap over the APEC communique, I can imagine that that adds to Mr. Macri's trepidations as all come to Buenos Aires. I would say that the IMF program, which was put together over the summer, didn't seem to take hold, but the recent revised program seems to be working well, creating much more stability this time. So hopefully that's a positive factor that will add a dimension of smoothness to him, but it doesn't absolutely, I agree with everything you said about the road to Buenos Aires for President Macri.
Yes, and I think we saw President Trump and last weekend in Asia, Vice President Pence, really make things difficult for their host. In Canada for the G7, there was a communique, which is what the Sherpas and all work on, to get the wording just right, to negotiate out the difficult issues and maybe leave one or two for the leaders. That was all apparently agreed, but then on the plane coming back, President Trump got irritated with, you know, our great ally in Canada, with Prime Minister Trudeau, and repudiated the agreement really around the trade wording. And then again, in APEC, that's the Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation Group, by the way, it's the first time ever that there's been a leaders meeting for APEC that has ended without a communique and at least some semblance of agreement. So whatever the pomp and ceremony of the meetings, all of the leaders in Buenos Aires, and there will be plenty of that, it will be the backstage drama that will be on everyone's mind. And the key there will be a meeting that is scheduled between President Trump and Chinese President Xi.
Absolutely. Well, as you say, there is what happens in the room and then there's what happens outside the room. Why don't we start with in the room and then we'll move into outside the room, as you were just foreshadowing. So in terms of the substance of the actual leaders' discussions in the room, what do you think are going to be the general issues on the minds of the attendees?
Well, Mark, the leaders always have an important session on the global economy. And in fact, it was the global financial crisis that triggered the first G20 meeting at leaders level, which I think you yourself had a hand in at the end of 2008 in the midst of the financial crisis then. And the G20's predecessor, the G22, which did not go at leaders level, but was a very important set of meetings for finance ministers, began, I guess, a decade or so earlier after the Asian crisis.
And so, you had a wee bit of a hand in that.
Indeed. We realized when we were trying to address the Asian crisis, I was in the U.S. Treasury at that point with the IMF, that I knew very easily how to phone up my counterpart in Germany or in Japan or in the U.K., but I did not know my Korean counterpart in the Korean Treasury or Ministry of Finance or in Indonesia or Turkey and all of these kind of Brazil. And so we began what was then called the G22, bringing together finance ministers just representing their own countries, finance ministers of the big emerging market economies, as well as the developed countries. And that was the beginning of what is now quite regular, usual, and many-pronged focus of the G20. But anyway, back to the room this year. The leaders have sometimes been very concerned in this global economy session about real risks to the global recovery. And for example, when Europe was at the height of its crisis in 2012, but this year, the latest projections for global growth are pretty decent. There will be debate about whether the recovery can continue. Is it going to stutter at some point? And where are the potential trouble spots? I expect that countries from the emerging markets, and as I said, all the big ones are represented in the room, will be worrying about Fed tightening and whether this could weaken their economies or threaten their currencies, whether it could induce what was called the taper tantrum back when there was some signaling that the Fed might tighten a few years back. I think that the other concerns that will be in the back of people's minds, financial markets after a terrific year, or stock markets, global stock markets after a terrific year, mostly for much of this year, have had a very bad October and somewhat bad November. And some economists are beginning to say maybe that's some foreshadowing of a global slowdown. The oil price has also declined. So there might be a little more anxiety than one might have expected several months ago. And just one comment that I will make about what's different inside the room this year. There are a number of leaders who have many other things on their minds. Normally, the UK, as you know, is punching above its weight in these international meetings. But with Prime Minister Theresa May embroiled in Brexit negotiations with her own party, as well as with Brussels, she will probably have less to contribute. Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, who a year ago was heralded as maybe going to be the leader of the free democracies and so on, is weakened politically. And others in the room have their own issues. You know, the Brazilian leader is about to be succeeded by Bolsonaro, who comes from a very different view. So it's going to be a different group this time.
Absolutely. And I'd expect, before we get on to more exciting topics, that they'll have regular discussions about financial regulation to examine how the post-crisis reforms are proceeding. There'll be discussions about international financial institutions and a range of issues specific to the Argentine presidency. I don't know if you have any views on or comments on those kind of issues.
Yeah, well, on FinReg, financial regulation, it will be nowhere near as front and center as after the crisis. But one could imagine that Financial Stability Board Chair Mark Carney, also, of course, Governor of the Bank of England, will make a presentation to the leaders about the progress that's been made in implementing post-crisis reforms, how those reforms are impacting the economy, and what should be the areas of focus going forward. On specific details, he may also talk about the importance of centrally clearing over-the-counter OTC derivatives, making sure that central counterparties can be resolved effectively to shore up the systemic strengths of the financial system. I think he will note that the reforms that the G20 has pushed have not, they've sometimes been accused of making it more difficult to finance, or banks more reluctant to finance much needed infrastructure investment. I think he will push back on that. And he will look on the situation on correspondent banking relationships, which, as you know, underlie a lot of the global financial system. I don't think there will be too much on the international financial institutions. There's been some call to have another IMF quota increase, which, of course, the IMF would love. But that will depend, again, on this always needs both U.S. push and then everybody else to pull the U.S. over the line at the last. There are a bunch of other issues that usually there's some discussion about development issues and what is happening in Africa. The one African country in the G20, South Africa, has a new leader with, I think, a lot of hopes behind him. There will be questions about that. And international taxation is another issue that has been pushed a lot by the G20 in very important work that the OECD has done to try to improve the way that the coordination so that companies are not able to shift their profits around and shield them from taxation. I think there may be a particular push at the moment. It's kind of in the air, especially in Europe, around taxation of technology companies, but the US will probably also want to push back on that. Now, Argentina, every host country wants to put its own stamp on the agenda, and they've been organizing some work around the issue of the future of work. You know, a lot of people are concerned that technological change, machine learning or artificial intelligence will alter labor markets, and that a lot of one estimate is that 800 million jobs between now and 2030, which is actually not that far away, will be replaced by automation. And there's a question of how should governments respond to that with social safety nets, changes in education, and so on. So there will probably be a discussion about that. One of perhaps a slightly cynical comment I would make is that that's the kind of issue that the group around the table may not, and even behind them, the finance ministers, may not have so much expertise in. So I suspect that that might be more about expressing worries and less about proposing solutions.
Well, thank you. So sometimes the topics around the room are not the most exciting, but I think your presentation shows very vividly that notwithstanding that, there's important work being done in the G20. But very frequently, there is lots of drama outside of the meeting room that creates a stir and grabs the attention of the media. Drama surrounding the European crisis, tensions between the U.S. and Russia were certainly evident in the days in which you were on summit duty, and you certainly have vivid remembrances of some of these dramas. So I have two questions for you. The first is, what are your most memorable recollections of drama in your time? And secondly, as you foreshadowed already, this year's drama seems to be shaping up as a meeting between President Trump and Xi that will particularly delve into trade issues. Trade issues are going to be on the minds of everybody in Buenos Aires. And is the real Buenos Aires story, in your view, likely to be about a G2 drama?
Well, let me take your last question first, because I think that's really important. Yes, I think the real story in Buenos Aires is going to be about the G2 drama. And it's very hard to predict how that will work out. My sense is that the Chinese have many different levels of the government have been trying to get a sense of just what they need to do in order to calm down the trade war. As you know, President Trump has threatened a big increase in tariffs on imports from China starting January. This trade war is, by the way, maybe all wars, but certainly trade wars don't help anybody. And many of the countries around the table know that this drama is perhaps the one that will affect their own economies most of all. They may well make some comments about how important it is to get over these problems and to allow the smooth sailing of the trade system, but I don't expect that that will have a big impact on either of the leaders. The real wild card is President Trump. We don't know if he will be willing to, a little bit like with the U.S. and Canada and Mexico, the new NAFTA or the conversations with Europe, if he will be willing to take what might be a fairly modest change and declare victory. It seems, and one of his key staffer or key people in his government who will be with him in Buenos Aires is Treasury Secretary Mnuchin. We know that Steven Mnuchin is in favor of cooling down the temperature on the trade wars and finding a way forward. But the vice president's willingness last week to blow up the APEC meetings, blow up in the sense of resist agreement, seemed to reflect not just a worry about trade and economics with China, but a shift towards a more aggressive posture altogether. So was he playing bad cop and then President Trump will come and play a good cop or a better cop with President Xi? It's really hard to predict. I suspect that nobody knows that, maybe not even President Trump himself. And that is very different because, as you know, usually these encounters are pretty carefully stage managed. Nobody wants a leader to be embarrassed by some surprise from the other side. So there's a sort of general understanding that you try to sort out as many things as you can at the Sherpa level and then just leave one or two things for leaders to finish and bring agreement on. I think in this case, people will be going into that meeting just really not knowing quite what to expect.
I think that's right. And I think that in my conversations around the world, I find that many look to the U.S. and they look to various individuals in the administration and who may be saying things that are perceived, rightly or wrongly, as at odds with each other. And there's a lack of certainty about who to listen to at any given time. And I've noticed that all throughout the world, there's a cottage industry arising where analysts put odds on various outcomes and the like, and the odds shift every day. So I totally agree with all that you said. Do you have any vivid recollections for us?
Well, one of them, actually, you mentioned recently was President Putin suddenly disappeared from Brisbane when Australia was hosting because everyone at that stage was up in arms about Russia's support of the Ukrainian secessionists and he didn't want to hear it. Another one was in Turkey in 2015, the G20 was just ahead of the Paris climate talk and the French Sherpa, who's Laurence Boone, now the chief economist of the OECD, and I were very keen to get language agreed in the G20, which is a group that's easier to corral at a level of leaders where deals can be done, that would help smooth agreement in the Paris talks. But the Turkish hosts were much less keen and pretty keen on their coal plants and so on. So in the end, she and I were trying to get agreement at the last minute on key wording, and we had to creep around and do shuttle diplomacy inside the room of the leaders were supposedly talking about some quite different topic, and we were going around to each delegation, to Korea, to Turkey, to Canada, to Argentina, to get agreement on the final words that would help to smooth the Paris Climate Accord. Nobody had any idea that the big issue of the Turkish meeting was the Climate Accord. They thought that was all going to happen in Paris.
That's excellent to hear. As good stories, I have my own, and I think I've conducted a good bit of shuttle diplomacy, as you call it, in my lifetime as well. Well, we've been talking about the substance and the drama, but perhaps listeners are wondering, what's a Sherpa? And perhaps the listeners may even wonder if you have a yak.
Well, we certainly have yaks, which always amused President Obama, and he always used to point this out to others and want to meet the yaks and so on. And it was actually in the U.S. government quite a sought-after and critical position because, if you'll excuse the pun, you know, yaks do a lot of heavy lifting. They make a lot of the calls. They do a lot of the negotiating. They support the Sherpa at the meetings. These big meetings require a lot of preparation, and obviously, the bulk of that may fall on the host country, but at least in the old days, the United States would usually have an interest in managing everything. You know, the U.S. may irritate some countries, although people might now be missing it, cares about what goes on in the world more generally. And so the Sherpa is trying to negotiate how we're going to approach an issue. We had a time once where we were pushing for commitments around women in the labor force. And the Chinese delegation was saying, well, we don't want to make a commitment to increase the women in the labor force because actually we're at a different stage in our development. And maybe that's not going to increase. And then the Mexicans were saying, well, we have such a low number of women in the labor force that we can't possibly increase it and or get to any level like others. So just negotiating many of those details, which are not important, they're not on the front pages, or many of the details about the financial stability work. It doesn't make the front pages, but it helps to knit together the world economy, the way that countries understand each other. And that's a lot of what Sherpas and Yaks are doing in the preparation. Of course, you have to brief your leader, which in my case, I was lucky. I had a very engaged and smart leader to brief. And then you have to figure out how to use the power of the leaders to get something that is not possible at a lower level or from others. So all of those things are what Yaks and Sherpas do. And of course, we're having meetings, throughout the year on different issues. There's in the G20, another important thing we should mention, maybe taking for granted that your listeners know, because the G20 grew out of this finance minister's process, there is a very important finance ministry track. And so during the year, finance ministry officials meet and sort through issues that are of relevance to the global economy and financial matters. And they meet sometimes with central bankers. And that's an important element then of the leaders' meetings. Over time, with different interests from different countries, the process has spawned meetings of labor ministers, agricultural ministers, environment ministers, energy ministers. And some of those can end up with the lowest common denominator agreements. But again, it helps to keep countries informed about what's going on in the rest of the world, which, quite honestly, we live in a global world, and that's very important.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you for the mention of the finance track, since that's what I ended up dedicating many years of my career to. So to wrap up, usually there's not too much drama inside the room. There's drama outside the room. That appears that might be the case for Buenos Aires. But more philosophically, the G20, as you noted, acted very boldly during the crisis, provided macroeconomic support to the world in the face of the steep downturn. We increased IMF resources, toughened financial regulation, changed global governance structures to reflect the rise of emerging markets. And some say the G20 should be a coordinating body for the world, especially on macroeconomic policy. And some criticize the G20 for falling woefully short these days. I've always been in the camp that believes it's unrealistic to think national governments will coordinate on macroeconomic policies, for example, very extensively in normal times, given divergent cyclical positions and worldviews. But I still think that it's useful for leaders to get together. If nothing else, they hear what's on each other's mind. They may take this into account to a greater extent in their own thinking. They know who to call when a crisis breaks out or it's important to do something. And they're more mindful of general issues that are being discussed in the global economy, and they provide an umbrella for work at lower levels to go on. How do you see this?
Well, I completely agree, Mark, that I would say the G20, and it's not just the leaders meeting, but all of the process that you and I have discussed, provides really important connective tissue between countries and between governments. And if you think back, the very early days of countries beginning to reach out to the rest of the world, set off in ships and so on, diplomacy was always a very critical part. Of course, there was also war, but diplomacy was also important as a way to smooth international relations. And we all have telephones and faxes and emails, social media and so on. But meeting people face to face, discussing what's on their minds, helps you to understand what the problems are, helps you to be able to reach out at times of crisis. Two other points I'd make about the G20. One is that it's not a forum where there is deep expertise, like in climate negotiations or trade negotiations or so on. It's also a forum where that began and has continued with all of the countries around the table as equals. As you know, in many fora around the world, many of the global fora, there's a fault line between developing and developed countries, north and south. And in the G20, there is more of a sense of a collective responsibility. Now, that can be overestimated, but I remember my colleague from Indonesia, some in the middle of a very heated debate that was separating developed and developing countries around trade. He said, look, we're in the G20. We should take off our trade negotiator hats and put on our G20 hat. And that means try to find places where we can agree and move forward, rather than retreat into our corners. And that is a really important feature of the G20. It has been a really important feature of the G20. My last point is that, yes, I agree with you that countries are not going to
act collectively on the macroeconomy, although they have on financial regulation, absent a real pressure and crisis. But it's possible to get many other things done in this kind of a forum because you've got leaders there who don't want to appear to be holding up agreement on something that is clearly a good thing. And that's where the US soft power used to be very important. So as the Sherpa, I wasn't hosting generally, but I would think of which are the things that we really want to get achieved and can we manage those? And for example, in Australia, we got agreement about action for Ebola. That was nothing to do with G20 agenda, but the Ebola crisis was raging and this was a place where you could get agreement on important support for WHO, for new facilities at the World Bank and so on. I mentioned the climate example. The trade example was another one where leaders are kind of, there's a sort of collective pressure. And there are, I mentioned women in the labor force. There can be a lot of issues that you manage to get agreement on that may seem small, but over time can add up to quite important changes. And there aren't other places where you can get those sorts of things agreed.
I absolutely agree with that. We actually created an IMF Ebola facility at Brisbane as well. I remember at Pittsburgh working to get agreement on shifting more IMF voting power to emerging markets. And I remember in Pittsburgh also working on language that created the foundation for what became Basel III. And I loved your comment about connective tissue. We live in an interdependent world, and there's always going to be economic stresses here and there, and we're always going to need multilateral cooperation. So I very much welcome all your remarks. And I should thank you profusely for joining us today for this excellent conversation. It's been very enlightening for me.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It was fun.